who is a professor of philosophy in the Faculty of Comparative Literature at Fordham University in New York. And Jennifer specializes in continental philosophy and philosophy of literature, and really in literature as well, I would say. And has written 3 books as well as numerous articles. Book on Heidegger, Hölderlin, and the subject of poetic language, The Ecstatic Quotidian, Phenomenological Sightings in Modern Art and Literature, and Exotic Spaces in German Modernism. And she has a great article, I mean, many great articles, I'm sure, but a great article I particularly like in the British Journal of Aesthetics from 2014 on neuroscience and phenomenology in literature. All right, I'll just say, even though we're a small group, let me first say that the British Society of Aesthetics has given us generous funding. And let me also say that we'll use a hand finger rule, but I think in our current configuration, we can just casually chat after the talk. All right, Jennifer.
Thank you. All right, thanks, Stacey, very much. Thank you for coming. So my talk is called Imaginative Envisioning, Challenges in Rilke and Kafka. And I'll start by saying that to see or perceive visually is one thing. To introspectively imagine, or what I call envision, involves a distinct activity of consciousness, one that does not require the perceptual presence of the object seen. I shall show how this discontinuity between vision and envisioning, operative throughout the history of philosophy, is engaged in modern literature by Rilke and Kafka. Recent scholarship on both writers has been dominated by visual perception as a central preoccupation of their works. For Rilke, this has not only to do with the profound integration of visual art into his poetic thinking, but also with its phenomenological resonances, since Ketja Hamburger pointed out in her groundbreaking study of Rilke that seeing and looking in his works can be thought of as pregnant in the sense that Husserl described it. While Rilke's poetics of vision has subsequently been interpreted to be imaginatively overturning the traditional segregation between the subject and its object, Rilke is read in quite a different way. For Kafka in recent literary studies, if you're keeping up with Kafka studies, visuality and looking are now fashionably interpreted through the lens of cinematic perception and voyeurism, among other motifs. But it has been overlooked that both writers consider the problem of envisioning, or mental envisioning, through depictions of inward imagining, reading, window gazing, and daydreaming. I will suggest in this paper, Rilke and Kafka contend thematically with the problem of the inner life and its relationship to the world. The envisioning they envision, I argue, is inseparable from their respective poetics of perception. For aesthetics more generally, this treatment of envisioning in Rilke and Kafka may support taking inner envisioning into account in coming to understand the literary imagination. So I might briefly talk about the philosophical context, rehearsing some pretty well-known ideas about envisioning and imagination. Envisioning, or the inward perception of visual or other images, is central to the theories of imagination since Aristotle, and credited by Aristotle as having a role in all of cognition. As we know, imagination was classically defined as a faculty that brings forth images. Aristotle defines fantasia as that in virtue of which an image, phantasma, occurs in us in the absence of perception. It is classed as a form of memory, which sends impressions on the mind, Aristotle says, like a seal in wax. Yet by modern philosophy, images are demoted. For Descartes, images are inessential to the thinking self, while for Hobbes, they may be but decaying sense. Kant, however, echoes Aristotle's view to some extent when he claims, in the Critique of Pure Reason, that imagination, or Einbildungskraft, is a power to bring to mind objects in their absence. Das Vermögen, einen Gegenstand auch ohne dessen Gegenwart in der Anschauung vorzustellen. So in der Anschauung, bring it to mind, but it's really bring it to intuition. And Kant's notion of the productive imagination spurs interest in the role of imagination for aesthetics, as it does for Coleridge, for whom primary imagination is somewhat continuous with perception. But the relevance or even existence of mental images was in due course vigorously challenged. Early 20th century analytic philosophy, with Gilbert Ryle, for instance, denied the relevance of mental images. Imaging occurs, he says, but no images are seen. Imaging, imagining, is only fantasizing that something is seen. So imagining is just propositional. Cognition then was widely described as linguistically based to the exclusion of images, while even in literary theory, some scholars, like William Gass, argued that literary cognition is not quasi-visual or perceptual in nature, but conceptual. He writes, there are no descriptions in fiction, only constructions. Meanwhile, however, phenomenology, from Vitano through Husserl and Sartre, maintained interest in the inward or mental envisioning through the mid-20th century. For Sartre, in his extensive analysis of imagination, the mental image was, he says, an analog of perception, not merely its residue. The image was a mode of consciousness, not an object in the mind. And the image, literally, he calls it a nothing, was ontologically divergent from perception. In the latter quarter of the century, cognitive theory reasserted interest in mental imagery as part of cognition, even if subordinate to linguistic structures, or in something like mental representations with perceptual content. And inner imaging may be especially relevant to understanding literary experience. In the last two decades, cognitive psychology and neuropsychology, and even cognitive literary theory, have revived interest in images insofar as they account for mental imagery as neural or other patterns that produce, and this is Damasio's words, inner percept-like appearances of introspection in the mind's eye, or, and here is Pinker, patterns loaded from the long-term memory rather than the eyes. Some of these theorists point to neurological evidence that the brain's activities in imagining and even in literary reading provoke activity in the visual cortex that's continuous with seeing objects. If vision has been regarded as a constructive process, then now seen for many in light of an active view of cognition, we can talk about that in the discussion, so too envisioning has also been argued to be a constructive process and not merely a picture of former perceptions. For example, Merleau-Ponty's view of imagining, or Peter Schwanger and his view of the construction of inner images. From the perspective of evolutionary psychology, Gerdenfors has argued for an image-like situational modeling, and Robert Arp for scenario visualization as crucial to the development of human thinking. Both terms describe the ability to form and manipulate something like mental imagery or a representation that, quote, functions in the same way as a map or an image or picture, unquote. In the case for mental imagery, Costelin, Thompson, and Gannis define the mental image as a quasi or functional picture such that perceptible properties of a representation give rise to a subjective experience of perception, and they argue for the role of such images in many kinds of cognition. But theorists have also widely aimed to think of images as other than mental pictures. The notion of perceptual mimesis, elaborated in literary theory by Elaine Scarry, has been used to express how imaginings are more like simulations of perceptions rather than simulations of objects of perception, and this finds resonance in cognitive theories. Philosophers have described imagery, or something like mental imagery, as reliant on neural simulation of brain processes. I'm thinking of Barcelou, but also Curry. And such simulation does not entail the creation of picture-like resemblances in the mind, but rather something like the evocation or construction of perceptual patterns or schemata that are experienced in a quasi-visual way. And of course, this also applies to other kinds of images like auditory or kinesic, but I'm specifically talking about those with the visual sense. While in some ways, like visual perception, mental imaging or envisioning is of course discontinuous with perception. Inner images would be, in any case, unlike visual perceptions in being less vivid, less determinate, not subject to further inspection or intersubjective verification. Further to this discontinuity, it is argued by Casey, for example, that the performance of perception is incompatible with the simultaneous performance of imagining. We often close our eyes in order to imagine something. At the same time, there may be admitted in aesthetic experience a tension between imagination and perception, such as when aesthetic experience seems to invite the extension and modification of what is actually seen. And I'm thinking that maybe Coleridge's primary imagination, which cites perception, is something like that. Or in the experience of seeing as, or when objects of perception are able to symbolize something other than themselves. The tensions between perceiving and imagining converge in Rilke and Kafka and are relevant to an increasing interest in their works in cognitive literary studies. Without committing a particular view here of the nature of envisioning or what mental imagery is like, I want to turn to these two writers now to support the relevance of something like inner envisioning for at least literary experience. While I am limited by the scope of this paper, this study would contribute to a larger view of literary modernism as consciously reflective about cognitive experience. And I apologize in advance if I assume too much familiarity with the works I'm about to discuss. But we could, of course, talk about them in the question part further. So turning first to Rilke, these are the texts I'm going to talk about. The first three are from the New Poems. Actually, the first five are from the New Poems. In the first three, The Panther, The Blind Man, and The Reader. By the way, I usually do this in German when I talk about Rilke, but I assumed that this wasn't a modern languages audience, so I'm going with the translations, which are perfectly up for debate if you aren't happy with them. So in the first three poems, I'm going to talk about how Rilke's speaker describes subjects who have a kind of compromised vision, and the speaker attempts to posit some sort of envisioning on behalf of those subjects. Whereas in other poems, Rilke seems to find objective correlatives for envisioning vision. That's what I'm going to try to say is the case of The Bowl of Roses and The Rose's Interior, especially the latter. And then I'm going to cite a couple more works by Rilke, The Notebooks of Malta Lorenz-Brigge, which is his novel, where you have a subject experience a kind of visual chaos. He's upset by the urban intensity around him when he comes to Paris, but he achieves a certain aesthetic vision. And in his late poem, Windows, which was published after his death in 1927, he describes the window as a kind of metaphor for the ambiguity of looking outward that is also a kind of looking inward. So that's what I'm going to talk about in Rilke, and then we'll turn to Kafka after that. So there are countless ways in which Rilke's works engage visual perception and, of course, ask the reader to imagine inwardly. I will point to just a few of the many moments where the nature of seeing and envisioning is explicitly thematized. In several poems of the Neue Gedichte, or the New Poems, Rilke asks us to imagine the seeing or envisioning subjects of his poem, and to some extent what they perceive or envision. Some examples include animals, a blind man, a young man reading a book. All of them experience some kind of compromise of ordinary vision. This subjective experience is only half intuited by the speaker of the poem, reflecting, of course, on the limits of intersubjectivity. While we can see the objects of others' vision and project the alternative standpoint from which they would see the same, we have no direct observational access to what another inwardly envisions, or how a perception available to others is invisibly extended or modified in another's mind. But the advantage of literature here is, of course, as of all fictionalizing operations, that it need not respect these boundaries. In The Panther, the speaker attempts at intimation of the animal's vision and of his interior reception of the perceived world. The description of the physical confinement of the panther in its cage, by the way, this is a picture of one such animal that was in the Jardin des Plantes in Paris at the time when Rilke was visiting this. So I think that might have been the very one he saw. It's possible. I don't know how many they had. Anyway, so he was watching the animal in its cage, and he gives the description of the physical confinement of the panther in its cage. This is deduced for the reader not only from the circling of the panther's body in the poem, but the description of the 1,000 bars across which his vision passes. Beyond those 1,000 bars, says the speaker, there is no world. Presumably, the panther would have at least partial perceptual access to the same objects from within the cage as the viewer would from without. And it is said that, exhausted by its circling, the panther's gaze takes nothing in. From the stance of an inactive view of cognition, we might say that the confining cage breaks off the invitation of the environment to any action, thus nullifying the ordinary significance of perceived things as those to be pursued, followed, wandered through, enjoyed, or avoided. But Rilke's speaker goes further to speculate about the implications of the deadened vision. The vision is cut off by the confinement, and so too may be the inner envisioning, such as Rilke seems to speculate that an animal might have. May that be compromised? Thus, the speaker's attempt at portraying what the animal himself envisions, itself envisions, inwardly also ends in darkness. And image enters, goes through the tense silence of the limbs, and extinguishes in the heart. In Der Blinde, the blind man, the lack of vision of the subject yields a closed interior sensed by the speaker in its very inaccessibility. I just give you a little fragment of some of these poems. Rilke's interest in the motive of blindness correlates to his investment in seeing, or as one scholar puts it, in overcoming the intentionality of seeing. The blind man wanders the city, Rilke says, interrupting it, this is from the poem that I don't have here on the slide, interrupting it like a crack in a porcelain teacup. From the speaker's point of view, he is a surface against which images are reflected, for he cannot absorb them. And as if on a page, the reflection of things is painted on him, he does not take them in, only his sense of touch stirs, as if the world fingered in little waves. The figure of a blind man also appears in Rilke's novel, Die Aufzeichnungen des Alten Lords Brügge, the notebooks of Alten Lords Brügge, which I'm gonna talk about in a moment. And there too, the narrator is drawn by the contrast between the blocked outward perspective and the inevitable speculation by the narrator about the inner experience of one with no vision. To attempt to imagine the latter engages envisioning both actively and transitively. To attempt to overcome the presumption of inner darkness in another's mind requires a distinctly self-conscious exercise of inward envisioning on the part of the narrator or speaker. But it may be that outward vision and inner envisioning are mutually dependent. You may know the treatment by the theologian John Hull, who described his gradual experience of going blind with first a wild proliferation of internal imagings, and then the gradual erosion of his inner visual landscape as his visual memories receded entirely. But according to Oliver Sacks's study, The Mind's Eye, the experience of residual or inner vision among the blind varies radically, with some retaining and even augmenting vivid inner visual life perceptions, and others having none at all. We also know now that specific deficits in vision, for instance, where a subject with brain damage cannot see the left side of objects, will also have the same deficit in his representation of space. So his inner envisions will also be compromised in the same way. The alteration rather than dependence between visual perception and inner envisioning might best be described in terms of the experience of reading. When we engage deeply in the reading of a novel, for instance, the visual world does not cease to be present, but its immediate salience recedes as we focus on an imaginary world in the story. Even the perception of the print of the words on the page on which we are focused recedes from the forefront of our attention, becoming a mere conduit for the inner perception or mimesis of perception of imagined objects. In The Reader, Rilke's speaker describes a human subject reading. After describing the reader sinking into the other reality of his book, the speaker asks, What do we know how much he fades away until reluctantly he looks up, raising everything into himself that went on in the book below with eyes that, instead of taking, profferingly brush up against the ready full world. The reader described in Rilke's poem slips inwardly away from one realm of being into another, invisible to the observer, and his countenance is outwardly transformed. What most interests us here may be the way in which his gaze is described as giving or generous rather than taking in. As the reader looks up, his gaze does not seem to receive perceptual experience, but seems already full and rather to contribute to what he is seeing. The reader is saturated with that imaginative stratum of being from the book he is reading. Without access to that book and its content, the reader of Rilke's poem, of course, is challenged to vicariously sense the form, if not also the emotive or perceptual pull, of the reader's inner envisioning. It's a bit of a blank space. We don't know what he's reading. While the panther's gaze shuts down from the world, taking in an image that is then extinguished, and the blind man is said to take nothing in the reader, a potential exchange is suggested. That other level of being that is engaged inwardly by the reader from the book is given back through his imagination toward the physical world around him, which he confronts when he looks up. His gaze seems to be satiated with the inner world he has been imagining, a situation similarly described by the narrator of Proust's A la recherche du temps perdu, who experiences the landscape in his book, he says, far more vividly than the Cambrai before his eyes. In contrast, however, Proust's Marcel is himself both the narrator and the reader of the book that he says is much more powerful than the world around him. And so he's able to explain to the reader of A la recherche du temps perdu how and what within his own experience of reading is, in his estimation, far more perceptually rich and vivid than the reality he perceives when he looks up from the book. In Rilke's poem, too, such inner envisioning is provoked by reading, but it may also occur in other works spontaneously in the form of subject-directed visual cogitations, such as intensive gazing, wishing, and daydreaming, experiences, as we'll see soon, also prominently depicted in Kafka's writings. The question of interiority and exteriority arises for both writers. In Rilke's aforementioned novel, The Notebooks of Malta Lawrence Brigga, the protagonist finds himself alone in Paris at the turn of the century and precariously exposed to the chaotic influence of the urban city. I didn't quote from the reel of the chaos, I would just tell you about it, but then you'll see from this quote how he comes to an aesthetic resolution. So Malta's experience of vision is at first reported with great distress at the invasive intensity and proximity of the perceived world, the sights along with sounds and smells of which seem to intrude upon his very consciousness. This sort of experience of the modern urban city is described really beautifully in Georg Simmel's essay, The Metropolis and Mental Life. So Rilke's novel is at first a kind of novelistic treatment of that phenomenon. Malta gradually, however, achieves an aesthetic equilibrium, stabilizing himself from the reel of urban chaos as his visual perception becomes informed by an envisioning that is distinctly aesthetic. Malta, like his author Rilke, has been gazing at Impressionist paintings in the Louvre and comes to terms with the apparent visual disorder of his surroundings by seeing them as if in the framework of the painting. While Rilke, at the time of writing the novel, had spent a great deal of time in the service of Rodin and a considerable effort viewing Cézanne's paintings at a 1907 retrospective, his protagonist names Manet as a painterly influence. And in the passage where he describes Manet, he describes a composed perception of the city as if it were a painting. And here it is. What a little moon like this can do to everything. There are days when everything around one is softly illumined, not yet identifiable in the bright air, but nonetheless distinct. Sounds very much like an Impressionist, a post-Impressionist painting. Even what lies nearest is imbued with the tones of distance, is abstracted and only denoted, not revealed, and what relates to distance, the river, the bridges, the long streets and the squares squandering themselves among them, are what this expanse has collected behind it to be painted as if on silk. All are attuned to one another, are valid, are part of the whole, and form a completeness which lacks nothing. So Malta's education in seeing illustrates how a transformation of outward perception involves the registration of a deeper inner life. This is what he says about his whole experience of learning to see differently or aesthetically. I am learning to see. I don't know what it's about, but everything is registering in me at a deeper level and doesn't stop where it used to. There's a place within me that I wasn't aware of. In other words, learning to see for Malta is learning to see with a kind of interiority. Yet aesthetically, this may mean to allow one's vision of the world to be informed by envisioning. In various ways, Rilke is practicing this himself in the new poems, where specifically poetic phenomenology of imaginative perception is emerging. The balance between outward seeing and inner introspection is somewhat captured by Rilke's coinage of the term for inner space, or later, by 1914, he writes, world's inner space, Welt in den Raum, a concept that has come to dominate Rilke's scholarship. In this context, I read Welt in den Raum as Rilke's attempt to negotiate between vision and envisioning. For through this notion, Rilke poetically extends inner space to perception, suggesting the symbolic envelopment of the world in imagination. The aim of his rose poems, for instance in Die Rosenschale, seems to be, he says, to transform the world outside into a handful of inwardness. And then I'm going to cite another rose poem in a second. While the panther, the blind man, and the reader are conscious subjects who, for the very compromise of their vision or attention, do not take the world outside into the interior, Rilke's speaker throughout the new poems metaphorically transforms other objects of consciousness through the motif of vision and visioning. The roses in at least two of the poems become symbolic of imagination. Both open and containing, they are objective correlatives for the ambiguity between seeing and envisioning. This is a Cézanne image of some flowers. I think there's maybe roses, those yellow ones, but actually Rilke was looking at Neil Rose's, if you know that, when he wrote about it in his letters. The speaker compares, the speaker of his poems, compares the rose petals in both poems to eyelids, as when the roses are said to have an inner visual power. As he writes in Das Roseninnere, the rose's interiority, the rose's innerness, the perception of an external object can be taken into an envisioning vision. Might as well read the whole thing, my whole truncated version of it. Where is for this interior and outside? Many allow themselves to be filled, all too full, and flow over from inner space into the days which, ever fuller and fuller, close in upon themselves until the entire summer becomes a room in a dream. Wilke begins the poem with a question, where is to this inside and outside? And it is a question we could put to imagination. The imagination, it seems, overflows, yet it has no outside. This idea of an envisioning vision relies, I would suggest, not only upon the possibility of something like inner visual imagery, but also the mind's ability to negotiate some kind of resonance between inner envisioning and actual perception. Presuming that what Rilke describes is not merely a confusion of the imagined and the perceived, we may ask about the nature of their distinction in this case, how it works in aesthetic experience, and whether, and if so how, some cognitive quarantine of the imagined from the perceived is maintained through such interchange. Moving to Kafka on vision and envisioning, we're going to look at a very small passage from The Judgment, just the opening, from the opening paragraph. And the other works we can see almost in their entirety because they're very tiny. So An Imperial Message, we can look at most of it. The Street Window, Absent-Minded Window Gazing, and Wish to Become an Indian. And I'm suggesting that we're looking for these things in those texts, envisioningly gazing, so gazing out the window or gazing somewhere whilst imagining inwardly. And then a couple of treatments of window gazing that lead to or suggest inner envisioning, and then an example where Kafka presents something that's only inward envisioning. So several stories in Betrachtung, which is often translated as contemplation, a book of very short stories published in 1912-1913, can be observed for the evocations of imaginative as well as perceptual vision. Indeed, it has often been pointed out that Kafka's title, Betrachtung, or contemplation, may carry interior and exterior connotations as meditative thought as well as the contemplation of objects outside itself. It can also mean observation. The viewing in these stories, often from a window, constitutes a perceptual experience that may invoke qualities of inner imagining. In The Street Window and Absent-Minded Window Gazing, viewing, looking, seeing, or gazing constitutes the central event of the story. In these short prose pieces, the vision of the protagonist is not focalized in a single intentional direction. Rather, outward looking evokes inward experience, attention on one focal object oscillates with distraction in a larger visual field, and an apparently immediate perception becomes temporally distorted. In Wish to Become an Indian, the passage describes envisioning in the form of wishful daydreaming, where visual sensations are affected by and may overlap with those drawn from other senses, such as tactile and kinesic associations. The fact that the central image object of the wish disintegrates in the very process of its description, as we'll see, highlights the fragility of the merely envisioned in contrast with the perceived. Two of the stories center around the experience of a subject gazing out the window onto the street outside. But before turning to them, the ones in Betrachtung or contemplation, we should note that a window is also central to the opening of Kafka's breakthrough story of 1912, The Judgment, which he considered, and many consider, his most successful story. It's probably less famous than The Metamorphosis, but this was his breakthrough story, which he wrote in the course of one night, all at once. The situation of the story is that on a Sunday morning in early spring, Georg Bendemann daydreams, gazing out the window from his room on the first floor. He had just finished a letter to a friend from his youth who was now abroad, closed it in playful slowness, and then looked, elbows propped up on the desk, out the window at the river, the bridge, and the hills on the other shore with their delicate greenery. It's actually a very colorful passage, but the drawings that I'm giving you are all Kafka's drawings. They're just in black and white, but I thought at least they're by Kafka. This dreaminess of gazing out the window is indicated in several ways. Closing the letter with playful slowness, looking down at the river and the bridge, from which, by the way, if you've read the story, you know he will jump to his death. And at the banks across the way with their pale green. The recipient of the letter is also on the protagonist's mind. Georg is imagining someone absent in an as yet unnamed faraway place. Indeed, it is a friend whom Georg's father will later argue is but a figment of Georg's imagination. The subsequent narration of the story, as one scholar has described, unfolds as a dreamlike sequence of events. Indeed, the interior space of the household evokes the goings-on of what Kafka himself, in reference to this story, called his dreamlike inner life. The sense of interiority here has also been described by Judith Ryan as a convergence of Brentano's views of consciousness and Freudian insights, two views of the mind that admit a considerable role for imagistic thinking. The window gazing and the judgment ultimately presents a perception that is inflected by and inseparable from envisioning. Like the judgment, the street window presents a subject gazing out the window onto a street, where the window functions as a liminal space between inner experience and outward observation. That is a picture, by the way, of one of Kafka's windows, Kafka's own room. That's what the window he would have looked out. Fascinating. The street window. Whoever leads a solitary life and yet now and then wants to attach himself somewhere, whoever, according to changes in the time of day, the weather, the state of his business and the like, suddenly wishes to see any arm at all to which he might cling, he will not be able to manage for long without a window looking out onto the street. And if he is in the mood of not desiring anything and only goes to his window still a tired man, with eyes turning from the public to heaven and back again, not wanting to look and having thrown his head up a little, even then the horses below will draw him down into their train of wagons and tumult, and so at last into the human harmony. The narrative opens with a tone of melancholy isolation and the conditional identification of the protagonist as one who lives alone and needs some involvement with external events. As in many of the prose pieces of Contemplation, the narrative presents an impersonal, though private, point of view, illustrating a largely anonymous state of contemplation. The implied protagonist is made more specific only through the description of a man resting his head on the window latch, his eyes tired. But the window itself seems to have a literary function as a dual lens. It is the instrument through which a solitary individual may find objects of social attention, and it is the frame through which the reader can view the implicit mind of that viewer. It is suggested in the final dependent clause that the window gazer, with his absorbing look, will be imaginatively taken into the scene below. Recent scholarship on these stories, including this one but some others in the Contemplation, reads this window gazing in cinematic and voyeuristic terms. But in my view, this overlooks the play between outward vision and internal experience the stories suggest. Absent-minded window gazing likewise describes gazing out a window and seems to show how visual perception in the present is blended with expectation and retention, temporal expectation of something to come and retention. What are we to do with these spring days that are now fast coming on? Early this morning the sky was gray, but if you go to the window now you are surprised and lean your cheek against the latch of the casement. The sun is already setting, but down below you see it lighting up in the face of the little girl who strolls along, looking about her, and at the same time you see her eclipsed by the shadow of the man about to overtake her. And then the man has passed by, and the little girl's face is quite bright. The window again functions to mark the ambiguity between outwardly directed seeing and an inward feeling. The narrative, beginning as a collective we, describes an impersonal perspective following a general hypothetical remark about the arrival of spring. The narrative is set within the temporal frame of the changing skylight. The specification of the morning gives a temporal point of view from which to measure the atmospheric changes described, a technique echoing strategies of Impressionist painters, but also provides a psychological and perceptual frame. Presumably the day has passed without a look out the window. One is then surprised by the setting sun, the light of which is registered through its reflection on the face of a little girl strolling along. She is eclipsed by the shadow of a man passing from behind and overtaking her, after which her face is bright again. After closer examination, however, it seems that Kafka's narrator posits a simultaneity that would be impossible in direct perception. The sun lights up the little girl's face, and at the same time, zugleich is the German, the light is eclipsed by the shadow of the man about to overtake her. cinematographic readings, of which there are many in Kafka, I guess cinema studies and photographic studies of Kafka are all the rage, are at odds with how this is to work. While Alt describes this as a sequence of successive images, Beacon argues for a continuously guided gaze that offers no break in perspective. But there is an irresolvable temporal contradiction here. Thus, it may be that the composition offers a montage of perceptual moments that requires inner assemblage, an envisioning perspective that cannot be cinematographically translated. The viewer's perspective in this piece, indeed, has been compared by other scholars to the visual paradoxes of Magritte and M.C. Escher. In several of Kafka's stories, then, the window and its frame function to maintain ambiguity in the experience of contemplation, so that visual perception of the world implies the interior from which it is seen. We may recall Descartes' trope in the second meditation, where, unsure of the existence of the external world and unable to trust visual perception, the philosopher contemplates sitting by the window and looking out at the people passing, wondering if they are real. With the window, Descartes constructs a literary interior for his philosophical reflections. From Kafka's diaries, we also know that his most successful writing was executed at his desk near the window. He described the unbroken concentration he experienced in writing The Judgment, for instance, as a creative ideal, and yet we know how, during this very writing, he gazed out the window, because he records it in his diary. We know, for example, how it became blue in front of the window, how a wagon drives past, how two men are walking over the bridge, and so forth. What I would like to draw overall from these stories is that the perceiving and the imagining lend themselves to one another and intermingle. That is not, as for the rationalist philosopher, a cause for radical doubt, but for Kafka's literary productivity. Later in his writings, Kafka illustrates the challenge of envisioning in his story An Imperial Message, which also features a window gazer, though it's not apparent until the end of the story. I guess we'll just read some of it. I've truncated it a little. This is most of the story. The emperor, so they say, has sent a message directly from his deathbed to you alone at the furthest distance from the imperial sun. The messenger makes his way through the crowd, but the crowd is so huge, its dwelling places are infinite. If there were an open field, how he would fly along, and soon you would hear the marvelous pounding of his fist on your door. But instead of that, he is still forcing his way through the private rooms of the innermost palace. He would have to stride through the courtyards, and after courtyards through the second palace, encircling the first, and then again through stairs and courtyards, and then, once again, a palace, and so on for thousands of years. No one pushes his way through here, certainly not someone with a message from a dead man, but you may sit at your window and envision it as a dream when evening comes. The narrator explicitly envisions the impossible passage of the messenger through the inner palace and its chambers, the fields and courts and the outer palace and countless other palaces, whilst the message itself never arrives. Instead, it is envisioned. The passage ends, you may sit at your window and envision it as a dream when evening comes. The object of the dream, the imperial message, is no more determinate than the activity of the dreamer. And as Korngold and Wagner have pointed out, it is indeterminate as to whether you read the message in a dream or merely dream you read the message. In contrast to Proust, who describes, as I mentioned, inner envisioning as more vivid and lifelike than real perception, here Kafka is on the side of those like Sartre, William Gass, and Elaine Scarry, who have all highlighted the nebulous or feeble character of imagining. They have described its imprecision, its vagueness, or its instability in contrast to perception. Kafka explores this unstable status in several ways. While the central image in An Imperial Message is a message that never arrives and is merely imagined, Kafka's text, Wish to Become an Indian from Contemplation, explicates a visual imagining through the motif of the wish. Yet the narrative performs the evocation and disintegration of the envisioned image in one breathless sentence. Wish to become an Indian. But if only one were an Indian, instantly alert and on a racing horse, leaning in the wind, ever shaken in jerks above the quivering ground, until one shed the spurs, for there were no spurs, until one threw away the reins, for there were no reins, and hardly saw the terrain before one as a smoothly shorn heath, the horse's neck and horse's head already gone. The central image concept of this text is of a quote-unquote Indian riding on a horse across a landscape. Given Kafka's familiarity with the fiction of Carl May, who wrote American Westerns, we assume that this is a variation on that theme. The wish to become a quote-unquote Indian, as Native Americans were referred to, would be prototypical for early 20th century boyhood games, and indeed it is described by Walter Benjamin in his Berlin Childhood around 1900 as such a game. In the story, the image has visual aspects but relies upon and is made more vivid by virtue of tactile and kinetic associations, running, leaning, trembling, throwing. These associations are echoed rhythmically in the syntax with its progressive sequence of subordinate clauses, and if we were talking about it in German, I would point out some other aspects of it. The single but irregular rolling sentence composed of the clauses promotes a reading that echoes the restless movement depicted in the text. The wish, it should be said, is not a dream. By the way, two syntactical features which highlight the cognitive status of the wish would be the subjunctive form of the verb, wäre, in the German, and the other one would be the doch in the first clause, doch, for which there's not really an English equivalent. But it's very clear from the grammar that this is not merely a dream, and it is merely a wish, and it is positive by a narrative consciousness that, knowing it's a wish, would then presumably hold another unstated vision of reality in check. So there's a capacity on the narrator's part to recognize the instability of this. Unlike the state of play, which Benjamin describes, wherein the non-real state of affairs would be mimetically performed, perhaps with props, the wish remains cognitively unstable, a fact that Kafka exploits by gradually and visually erasing the very image it projects. By describing the shedding of spurs and tossing away of reins in the middle of the text, the narrator corrects and withdraws the specification of the central image, which is the object of the wish. The ending of the text, with the horse's head and neck gone, not only does not fulfill the expectation set up by the initial postulation, the wish to be an Indian riding on a horse, but contests and undermines it. Envisioning, divorced from present seeing, loses its hold. As in an imperial message, we are looking through a window of unreality, and the status of the object of envisioning is radically unstable. Yet this isolation of envisioning from vision for Kafka affords an acute observation of the imagination at work. So while philosophy, in turning to the problem of mental images, has relied in the main for its examples on the manipulation of memory images in the mind, or the prompting of isolated images or sets thereof in psychological research, it may be useful to examine envisioning in literature. Literature, after all, relies upon the construction of a whole nexus of interrelated imagined objects that have quasi-perceptual as well as emotive and cognitive pull. When we ask what mental images are like from the point of view of experience, are they schematic, blurry, colored, distinct, focused at points but fading at the periphery? Are they faint, vivid? We have to rely not only upon the visualizing capacity of the subjects, which scientific studies have now shown to vary considerably, but their introspective discrimination and their ability to describe their visualizations. It may be that literary writers, and perhaps in particular modernist writers, have distinct advantages in these tasks. In Rilke and Kafka, I suggest, we find a distinct reflection, maybe even a meta-discourse, about envisioning and vision. In the poems from Rilke's new poems that I discussed, we encounter, through indirect evocation, the panther's gaze, the inner darkness experienced by the blind man, and the saturated introspection of the reader. In each case, Rilke seems to provoke questions about the relationship between perceptual vision and envisioning, and his poetic ideal of their relation is offered in the aesthetic moments in Malta and in the rose poems, which symbolize imagination as an open structure of what I would call envisioning vision, a seeing that's already imaginative. Envisioning in Kafka is invoked through the motif of window gazing. Later in his writing, Rilke too takes up the motif of a window in a series of poems written in French. In the poems of Les Fenêtres, the window is described as an inexhaustible access to the ever-changing cornucopia of the visual world. Indeed, the window is called the other half of the world. One of these poems describes a window gazer who seems to live just by looking out the window. Because he finds there the ever-changing panoply of material for his visual contemplation, the experience is compared to the insight of reading. Rilke compares looking out the window to reading a book. He associates then the window gazer with the realm of inner introspection that he examined in the poem Der Leser, or the reader. But the window's framing of the world outside is ambiguous and also mirroring the viewer. We look and see out, but are given ourselves back in reflection. The glass may function as a space through which our own mirrored image overlaps with a vision of the exterior world, And in the second stanza of the fourth poem in the series, the speaker addresses the window in just these terms. Skipping the French again to the translation, you who divide and who bring together, as changeable as the sea, a mirror suddenly reflecting and blending our faces with what we see through you. In this poem, the glimpse of a self and implicitly the pull of interior space balances out, toward the end of the poem, the great excess of the outside. The balance between inner reflection and outer perception is maintained by the framework that the window, and implicitly the poem's language itself, provides. In contemplation, as we have seen, Kafka presents the window-gazing consciousness, where attention oscillates with distraction and exterior seeing evokes inner introspection. In Wish to Become an Indian, Kafka gives us a glimpse of an interior vision that, unsustained by perceptual experience, quickly disintegrates. In An Imperial Message, the window-gazing dreamer envisions a message that is ever withheld from the reader. In these stories, Kafka's depiction of the vision and envisioning consciousness does not achieve the visual equilibrium or imaginative equilibrium suggested by Rilke's late window poems, nor the aesthetic repose hoped for by Malta when he attempts to see the world through painterly eyes. Indeed, Kafka himself described his short prose works in Contemplation as, he says, glimpses into an infinite confusion. It may be that Kafka refuses to surrender the potential confusion between inner envisioning and outward seeing to the desire for clarity, lest the imagination be restricted in the process. Both Rilke and Kafka, then, I want to say, are writers of the liminal experience of vision and visioning, exploring in different and various ways the mind and its interaction with and exposures to the world through perception and imagination. Here, in conclusion, I can only summarize that the challenges to envision vision and visualize envisioning take different directions in Rilke and Kafka. Rilke, in the end, by the time of his Duino elegies, develops a salutary poetics, where the distinction between the perceived and imagined seems to dissolve, so that the world, with its own interiority, will be preserved in an angelic vision. The figure of the angel in the Duino elegies might be one model of that kind of reconciliation. Kafka never admits to such idealism of lyrical achievement. He remains fascinated by the confusion that may be had between the envisioned and the perceived, and in this sense, I might say, he submits to a grittier cognitive realism. And I would just say, in general, then, and in closing, that in contemporary philosophy, literature may be described largely in terms that don't pay very much attention to imagining, terms like pretense or pretended assertions, or reference to the theory of mind, or according to some other specific cognitive operations. These modernist writers' interest in envisioning might remind us of the importance of engaging something like images and other quasi-perceptual evocations in attempting to account for literary experience as such. Thank you.